contents, or your meeting with the source?
No. Marcus began to relax. This wasn't going too badly, he decided. 67. As it turned out, those questions were just the warm-up act. Marcus had completely underestimated what he was in for. Over the next 3 hours, without so much as a break to visit the restroom, Jenny Morris probed every part of his life, his career, his finances, his part-time work at Lincoln Park Baptist Church, the details of his compensation from Senator Dayton, his relationship with Pete Wong, how he had chosen each of the men on the security detail, why he'd said yes to going on the trip at all, given that he'd initially said no, and rather definitively at that. Then the questions turned to his relationship to the Raven.
Do you know the source? She asked.
I can't answer that.
That's not an option, said Morris.
Actually, it is, Marcus replied.
At least answer this, Morris pressed. Do you know his name?
I can't answer that either.
Why not?
Because I gave my word to the source that I'm not going to discuss any details regarding his identity. You know he's a male. You know I trust him. You know he has access. That's it. That's all I'm going to say.
Had you ever met him before?
Marcus remained silent. He had nothing more to say if she was going to continue this line of questioning. He knew his credibility with his own government was on the line. A lie would not only go against his own code of ethics, but could potentially cause President Clark to disregard the urgent warning about imminent war in Europe. Better to just decline to answer.
Do you believe he reached out to you, of all people, because he had met you previously?
Morris asked, trying from another angle. Marcus felt deeply uncomfortable keeping information from his own government. He had, after all, spent most of his adult life protecting his country and his government. Now he was protecting a man deep inside an enemy's inner circle. Yet, having given Alek Kraskin his word to protect his identity, he had no choice. So again, he kept quiet. So Morris changed topics, to one that made Marcus even more uncomfortable.
Your wife, Elena, and son, Lars, were they killed in a robbery attempt?
Marcus gritted his teeth. Yes, he finally conceded.
Shortly after their deaths, did you resign your position as special agent with the U.S. Secret Service?
Yes.
One of the killers died at the scene. Was the surviving perpetrator of these murders ever caught and brought to justice?
No.
Were any suspects ever arrested and charged in the case?
No.
So the case remains open today?
Marcus took a deep breath. Yes.
Any current leads?
Not that I'm aware of.
Does that make you angry?
Again, he had to pause to steady his nerves. Yes. There was no sense lying about that one.
Do you want revenge against whoever was responsible?
No. The lines on the display went crazy. Morris looked at him. He looked back and saw pity in her eyes. That only made the lines gyrate all the more.
Would you ever take revenge if you had the chance?
She was giving him a mulligan, and he was grateful for the small act of kindness. No, he said, with every muscle in his body tensed. The lines moved not at all. The final area of questioning that created no small measure of discomfort pertained to his private life.
Mr. Riker, after the death of your wife, did you ever remarry?
Marcus tensed again. What does that have to do with anything? He demanded.
Just answer the question, please. We're almost done. Did you ever remarry?
Marcus shook his head slowly.
You need to give a verbal answer, Mr. Riker.
No, he said softly.
Have you dated anyone in the last several years?
No. He suddenly felt very thirsty.
Have any women expressed interest in dating you?
Marcus couldn't imagine how this was relevant, but he answered anyway. Yes.
But you declined?
Yes.
During your travels with Senator Dayton, were you ever propositioned by a woman?
What? Marcus snapped.
Were you?
Morris asked calmly. Never, he replied. Then remembered to answer properly. No.
Not in the Baltic states?
No.
Not in Moscow?
No.
Were you in any environment, any situation, that could have been construed by you or by others as a honey trap?
It had taken several questions, but Marcus finally understood her purpose. He was a widower, potentially vulnerable to the efforts of a foreign intelligence agency to seduce him with romantic affections or sexual favors, compromising his credibility as a witness. Marcus was the only person who had met with the Raven. Everyone else in the U.S. national security apparatus was depending on his credibility. So Morris had to ask. Spy agencies had been setting honey traps for needy, vulnerable men from time immemorial. And the head of the CIA's Moscow station would not have been doing her job if she hadn't asked every relevant question, no matter how uncomfortable it made her subject. No, he said at last. 68. The White House, Washington, D.C., September 26th. In Washington, the day was just beginning, and the President of the United States was fuming. Andrew Clark entered the Oval Office at precisely 7 a.m. As a steward brought him coffee, the chief executive pored over every story on the front pages of the Washington Post and the New York Times. They were all about Luganov, his surprise trip to Pyongyang, his extraordinary press conference announcing the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, and his announcement that he intended to de-escalate tensions along the Baltic and Ukrainian borders. In a single day, the Russian leader had completely changed the media narrative about him. No longer was he regarded as a rapidly intensifying threat to global safety and security. Suddenly, he was being hailed as a man of peace and a viable recipient of a Nobel Prize. Disgusted, Clark tossed the papers aside and informed his secretary that she could send in the guests who were waiting in the lobby of the West Wing for their 7:30 meeting. The first to enter the Oval was Richard Stevens, the balding 64-year-old director of the CIA, who had previously served as the senior senator from Arizona and chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Following him in was Cal Foster, the silver-haired 71-year-old Secretary of Defense. A retired four-star general, Foster had served more than three decades in the U.S. Army and nearly 5 years as the supreme Allied commander of NATO. Also joining them was Bill McDermott, recently appointed Deputy National Security Advisor. The last man to enter the room was the White House Chief of Staff. Director Stevens began the briefing by giving the president and each participant a black leather-bound notebook embossed in gold lettering with the seal of the Central Intelligence Agency and the words, "The President's Daily Briefing." Underneath that was the president's name. Below that were the words, "Top Secret, Contains Sensitive Material." Inside was an 8-page bullet-point summary of the most urgent and important intelligence information the commander-in-chief needed to know. During the previous day's briefing, Stevens had introduced Clark to the emergence of a possible high-level mole in Moscow, codenamed the Raven. He'd given the president an overview of the mole's allegations and the 53 photos of documents the source had passed to an American case officer. No specifics about either figure were given, but plenty of caveats were. Stevens had underscored to the president how raw and unconfirmed this intel was. He'd also drawn the president's attention to the section of the PDB mentioning the fact that Senator Dayton had met with President Luganov in the Kremlin, promising that more details of the meeting would be forthcoming. Today, they were.
Mr. President, you'll find that the last five pages in today's PDB are a point-by-point account of Senator Dayton's conversation with President Luganov, the CIA director explained. These are the verbatim notes taken by our station chief in Moscow, who met with the senator and his team when they briefed Ambassador Reed. I'd like to go over this with you rather carefully, because we expect the senator to be here by 9, and when he arrives, we want you to be fully versed on what was said in the meeting, so we can focus our time with him on drawing some conclusions, and seeing if we can come to a bipartisan agreement on where to go from here.
Fine,
Clark said, leafing through the pages as he sat behind the resolute desk.
That said, Mr. President, Stevens continued, the first two pages of your brief focus on what we're learning from the Raven and his case officer. Page 3 is a summary of Russian military activity over the last 24 hours. With your permission, I'll cover these. Then I've asked Secretary Foster to discuss options.
What do we know about the Raven? Asked Clark. How close is he to Luganov? And how credible is the material he's passed on to us?
All excellent questions, and I will get to each one in turn, Stevens replied. But if you'll allow me, sir, I want to start with the identity of the figure we described in yesterday's briefing as our case officer, because, to a certain degree, our level of confidence in the Raven is predicated on our level of confidence in the one bringing him to us.
Very well, said the president. Proceed.
Thank you, sir. Now, keep in mind that the information we had regarding the Raven was only hours old when I briefed you yesterday. Therefore, I essentially gave you a mere abstract of what we'd received, because we believed it could be enormously important. But I did not bring more detail at the time, because there had been effectively no time to cross-check any of the information. Today, I can tell you much more.
Clark nodded, and Stevens continued.
This case officer, the person who made contact with the Raven, is not an actual case officer at all. He's neither an employee of nor a contractor for the agency, nor is he a foreign service officer or even an employee of the U.S. government. Not anymore.
But he was?
He was never with the agency in any capacity, but yes, he did work for the U.S. government in various capacities over the years.
Do you believe he is credible?
We do, Mr. President. He served in the U.S. military and received a Purple Heart. Later, he worked here at the White House for a time.
So who is it?
Marcus Riker.
Riker? You mean the Secret Service agent?
Yes, Mr. President, Stevens confirmed.
The one who lost his wife and son a few years back?
Yes, sir.
I thought he'd retired. What's he doing in Moscow, of all places?
Stevens looked to Bill McDermott.
I think I can explain that, sir,
the deputy NSA said.
Marcus has known Senator Dayton since he and I both served on the senator's protection detail on his Kodel to Afghanistan back in 04. They have totally different political views, at least on domestic and social issues. But when Dayton decided to go to Europe to raise his profile for a presidential run, he hired Marcus to help him put together a security team. Though Marcus does not support the senator's presidential run, he agreed out of friendship and, you could say, out of a sense of loyalty to the man.
Loyalty?
The president asked.
It's a bit complicated.
Give me the short version.
Well, sir, said McDermott, Marcus was under my command back in Afghanistan. So was a guy named Peter Wong. During Senator Dayton's trip to Kabul, we came under attack by the Taliban. Two of our choppers were shot down. One was a total loss. The other, the one Dayton was in, had survivors. We had to make an emergency landing and found ourselves in a pretty serious firefight with a clan of jihadists. All of my men fought with tremendous distinction, but no one more so than Marcus. When it was all over, Dayton credited Marcus with saving his life. Every year on the anniversary of that attack, Senator Dayton either calls Marcus personally or sends him a handwritten note. I've heard them get into some rip-roaring fights on policy and politics, but they genuinely like and appreciate each other. Marcus believes he got into the Secret Service in part on the basis of a recommendation Dayton wrote for him.
Loyalty, the president said.
Got it. So that's what put Marcus Riker in Moscow,
McDermott noted.
It's still not clear to us why this source, whom we're calling the Raven, came to Marcus. But Marcus says the Raven reached out to him, made the initial contact, and I believe him. Marcus believes the source is totally legit, says he's wired in at the highest levels, though he won't give us a name or a title or even a hint at who he is, out of fear of putting the man's life in danger.
We're sure it's a man? Asked Secretary Foster. No possibility of a honey trap?
Marcus says it is, and I have no reason to doubt him,
McDermott replied.
Riker has served our country honorably. He took a bullet in the line of duty, Mr. President. I don't see any evidence that suggests he was compromised, nor do I believe he could be.
Was Riker subjected to a PDD? Asked the White House chief of staff.
What's that?
The president asked.
He's referring to a psychophysiological detection of deception test,
McDermott said,
more commonly known as a polygraph.
So, was he?
The president asked. McDermott looked back at Stevens.
He was, sir, said the CIA director.
And?
He passed with flying colors. At that, Clark pushed his chair back from the desk and stood. He walked over to the windows and looked out at the falling leaves and changing colors of autumn.
So, bottom line, gentlemen, you believe this case officer, who is not a case officer at all, is credible. And by reading ahead in the PDB, I gather that the Raven's statements and the documents he's handed over to us have borne out so far, correct?
Yes, Mr. President, Stevens confirmed.
Meanwhile, we have Russian fighter and bomber squadrons and tanks and ground forces being transferred in recent weeks from the Pacific Theater to the borders of the Baltics and Ukraine.
That's correct, sir.
And the written orders the Raven turned over indicate that Luganov intends to use these forces to invade NATO allies?
Yes, sir.
And both the CIA and DIA assess that unless we move a whole lot of men and materiel into the Baltics in the next few days, Luganov actually does have a credible capacity to seize Latvia and Estonia in less than 60 hours, followed by Lithuania in another 48 to 96 hours, give or take.
We do, sir, Stevens confirmed.
Moreover, the Raven claims that Luganov's trip to Pyongyang is nothing but a smokescreen.
Correct.
Yet, Luganov has signed a strategic alliance with North Korea, and the North Koreans have promised to fully dismantle their nuclear program and turn all the components over to the Russians.
Correct.
Clark was now pacing around the Oval Office.
Not only that, but Luganov has just held a press conference in Pyongyang, saying fears of a Russian invasion of Ukraine and or the Baltics are preposterous. He says the Russian military is merely conducting exercises, and that in the interest of international peace and harmony, he has ordered all or most of these forces to be withdrawn by next week at the latest.
No one said a word. It was all true.
So, those are the banner headlines we're waking up to,
the president continued.
Luganov defusing two regional crises in a single day. Looks like a genius. A man of peace. And what do I look like if I mobilize the 82nd Airborne and the 101st and start moving battle tanks toward the borders of Russia?
Every eye in the room turned to the Secretary of Defense.
Mr. President, Foster said calmly, I don't see that we have a choice. We have to move, and we have to move fast. You can announce that the moment Russia really does remove 150,000 troops off the borders of our allies, you'll be happy to consider redeploying our forces elsewhere in Europe. But until then,
you have an obligation to ensure the NATO alliance is strong and that our capacity deterrence is unmistakable.
Clark stopped pacing.
My only obligation, as you put it, is to the American people, who elected me in no small part to end our involvement in overseas conflicts, not exacerbate them, and certainly not to potentially spark an international crisis by sending troops into a standoff with Russia. Until we have more information, until we have absolute proof that the war plan the Raven gave us is genuine, I will not send a single American soldier, tank, or plane into harm's way.
69. Moscow, September 26th. I think we need a plan to assassinate Luganov, Marcus said. Jennifer Morris was sitting at the kitchen table, reading a briefing on her agency laptop. Marcus was standing at the sink, filling a kettle to make a pot of tea. He had just finished cleaning his Glock 9mm pistol, which lay on the table across from Morris, along with a spare magazine. Beside them were bottles of cleaning solvent, gun oil, a soiled toothbrush, a cleaning rod, and a small box of Q-tips. It was clear, from the stunned expression on Morris's face, that he'd caught her completely off guard. But in his mind, the conversation couldn't wait.
"Assassinate the President of Russia?"
she whispered, standing and moving across the kitchen to have the conversation up close and as quietly as possible. "Yes," said Marcus.
"Are you insane?" she replied. "We're trying to stop a war, Riker, not start one."
"But what if Clark refuses to order U.S. forces into the Baltics?
Or what if he does, but he doesn't send enough? Or he can't persuade the rest of NATO to send forces to help us create a deterrent? What if Luganov simply moves up his timetable and invades earlier than the 7th? We can't base our entire plan on building up a big enough deterrent force in Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. We need a plan B."
"Maybe so," Morris said, "but it's sure not going to be an assassination."
"Why not? First of all, it's illegal."
"Okay, there's that."
"Second of all, who's going to kill him? You?"
"I'd rather not, but..."
"But what?"
Morris asked, incredulous.
"Riker, you really are mad. One, if you were actually to assassinate the leader of Russia, that's an act of war. And who's to say that would derail things? Why wouldn't Luganov's successor use the moment to invade anyway? Two, if you're unsuccessful, if you're killed or captured while trying to take out the leader of the Russian Federation, then you've given Luganov the ultimate pretext not just to seize the Baltics, but to carry out any other crazy attack he's planning. Three, it's a completely stupid idea. And four, did I mention how stupid an idea it is?"
"So you're saying you'll keep an open mind. Great," Marcus said, as the water came to a boil. "Tea?" Morris stood there, staring at him for a moment, then smiled and said yes. Marcus made them each a cup, and they sat down at the kitchen table and pushed aside the Glock and the cleaning supplies.
"Look,"
he said, "the Raven was pretty clear that the invasion scenario is being driven entirely by Luganov."
"No. He said the FSB chief supports him, too."
"Nemkov."
"Right."
"Fine," Marcus said. "But there's no indication that everyone else in the cabinet or even the War Council does," Marcus noted. "Do you have a copy of the transcript the Raven gave us of the conversation between Luganov and the Army Chief of Staff just before Luganov sacked him?" Morris pulled up the document on her laptop, and they reviewed it together. "General, you are asking us to capture and occupy three NATO capitals? President, and secure their annexation so that they might be rightfully reintegrated into Mother Russia. General, but not Kiev. President, not right now. General, would it not be in our interest to seize all of Ukraine instead,
The Ukrainians are very patriotic, and they're able fighters, but they are not members of NATO. Washington and Brussels will huff and puff, but in the end they will do nothing if we take Ukraine. I have wargamed this with my staff. I'm convinced we could get it done in a month to 6 weeks. President, but we can have the Baltics in 4 days. General, how is it in Russia's interest, if I may ask, to provoke such a confrontation with NATO when Ukraine is ours for the taking, with no risk of triggering Article 5?
So your point is that the head of the Red Army was sacked because he told Luganov that going after the Baltics instead of Ukraine was a mistake, Morris said. And you think maybe there are others around that table who harbor similar concerns?
What if there are?
Then wonderful. But what if there aren't?
Morris pushed back.
You don't have any proof, just a hunch. And how could you possibly justify a high-risk American operation to assassinate Luganov on a hunch?
Look, Jenny, the Raven made it perfectly clear to me that in Luganov we're dealing with a psychotic personality. The man thinks he's a czar. The Raven called him an old guard imperialist, willing to use any means necessary to take back lands he believes are rightfully his.
Can we safely assume there are members of his war council that support him, or at least won't risk countering him?
Absolutely. I grant you that. But if Luganov is gone, if he's taken out of the picture, do the members of that cabinet still move forward with Luganov's plan, knowing full well that they risk a nuclear war with NATO in the process? You've got to admit that if Luganov was dead, their calculus would have to change. And that might give the West the time we need to avert a full-blown war in Europe.
Morris said nothing for several minutes. She slowly sipped her tea and stared at the Glock on the table in front of her, while freezing rain pelted and rattled the windows.
So, hypothetically speaking, how would you do it?
She asked finally, looking him in the eye once again.
How would you take him out? You're not an assassin, Riker. And with all due respect, even if you were, you haven't fired a gun in years.
You're right, Marcus replied. But you're forgetting one thing.
What?
I'm a Marine. And if there was one thing I was taught, it was this. Be polite, be professional, but have a plan to kill everybody you meet.
Catchy, said Morris. So you have a plan?
Not yet, he admitted. But I'm working on it, and so should you. 70. Washington, D.C., September 26th. Senator Bob Dayton wasn't sure which meeting worried him more. The one he'd had with Luganov, or the one he was about to have with Clark. True, Luganov was a modern czar, ruthless and throbbing with ambition. But he was not a figure unheard of in the history of Russian rulers. Andrew Hartford Clark was something else altogether. Apparently willing to say anything and do anything to build his brand and advance his goals at all costs, Clark was the most polarizing yet thoroughly original and entertaining political figure Dayton had ever met or even heard of. The man routinely, sometimes hourly, provoked surges of raging emotions, both for and against him. He had single-handedly upended the Washington political establishment by winning first the Republican nomination and then the presidency, when not a single pundit or pollster had given him a chance. Few members of Congress, if any, had spent any time before the election actually considering what a Clark presidency would look like, how it would operate, or how they would interact with it. Dayton himself had bitterly railed against Clark in dozens of campaign speeches and hundreds of radio, television, print, and electronic interviews. In turn, he had seen his own approval ratings soar among the progressive base of the Democratic Party. Indeed, this was what had prompted him to think a run against Clark for the presidency was becoming not just plausible, but imperative.
as the leased Learjet touched down at Dulles International Airport and taxied to the signature flight support center for private aircraft, Dayton faced the most difficult decision of his political career. In less than an hour, he would be sitting in the Oval Office with a man he utterly despised, a man his supporters despised even more. To evince any hint of being ready to work together on the Russia crisis in a bipartisan manner with such a man could very well be political suicide. Yet not to work together, Dayton feared, could lead in short order to a nuclear disaster of incalculable magnitude. If this weren't bad enough, Dayton could hardly expect to sidestep the media and hope his conversations with Clark could somehow be kept confidential. Even before they'd left Moscow, Dayton had instructed his press secretary to pull out all the stops and line up every interview he could, and the young man had done his job. Tonight, Dayton was scheduled to appear on 60 Minutes to give an exclusive on his discussions with Luganov and the leaders in Eastern Europe who believed they were facing an imminent military showdown with Russia, and how the news out of North Korea could be dramatically changing the storyline. The following morning, he was set for back-to-back live interviews on ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, and MSNBC on the same topics. Surely his meeting with Clark would leak, and surely he would be asked about it in every interview. What would he say? In many ways, this was a potential presidential candidate's dream scenario, a big media platform at a moment of global import. Yet Luganov's moves were scrambling Dayton's playbook. The senator now had no idea what advice he wanted to give to Clark, or even how he wanted to characterize his meetings with Luganov or Clark to the press, and he was quickly running out of time to figure it out. The meeting did not go well. For starters, President Clark was not interested in being briefed by a man actively planning to run against him in the next national election. Twice, he interrupted the senator to ask if this wasn't all a ploy for big ratings and 15 minutes in the spotlight. Dayton told the president it was his moral and constitutional duty to rapidly deploy tens of thousands of American and NATO forces to the Baltics and to supply the Ukrainians with arms, ammunition, and intelligence. "The only thing standing in the way is your own inexperience and hubris," he shouted. When Clark accused Dayton of using the crisis for political gain, the senator responded, "Mr. President, if you refuse or even hesitate to come to the aid of vulnerable NATO allies in a moment of peril, you will undermine the greatest military and political alliance in the history of freedom." As McDermott would later relay to Nick Vannetti, the heated voices could be heard throughout the West Wing. Both men either were unable to control themselves, or believed that when the high-profile dust-up in the Oval Office inevitably leaked to the press, it would help them with their bases. "There was just one problem with such calculations," McDermott would tell his old friend.
"Both men seem to have forgotten a nuclear war might bode poorly for either of their political fortunes."
Moscow, September 26th. Marcus knew Jenny Morris would be no help in taking out Luganov. She'd humored him for a moment, but only because she believed he was kidding or yanking her chain. Pressed, however, she'd thrown Executive Order 12333 in his face, notably Part 2.11, which read, "No person employed by or acting on behalf of the United States government shall engage in or conspire to engage in assassination." Marcus was not only familiar with the order, he'd studied it quite carefully, as had all special agents, and he knew it wasn't quite as clear-cut as it might seem. Signed by Ronald Reagan back in 1981, the order never actually defined the term assassination, creating a significant gray area.
Several later presidents and their attorneys general had, in fact, concluded that targeted killings of terrorist leaders, such as Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda leadership, were not just legal, but morally justified. The order had never been tested in the courts, and over the past few days, Marcus had been asking himself whether an order inhibiting the nation's ability to act in self-defense was even constitutional. It wasn't that Marcus supported killing foreign leaders in general. Still, he kept thinking of what might have happened if someone had taken out Hitler before he invaded Poland, before he set the final solution into motion. At least 25 attempts were made against the Führer's life. Weren't men like Klaus von Stauffenberg and his colleagues, who initiated the much-heralded, if unsuccessful, Operation Valkyrie, heroes for at least having tried to stop a madman from murdering millions? What about Dietrich Bonhoeffer? His story cut closer to home. He was a German Christian, a Protestant pastor and theologian. When Hitler outlawed the preaching of the gospel and the teaching of the Bible and moved to take over the state church, Bonhoeffer first started an underground seminary, training young men to remain faithful to the teachings of Jesus instead of selling out to the Nazis. In the end, however, after much prayer and study, Bonhoeffer joined a conspiracy to assassinate the Führer to prevent him from destroying the Germany he loved. Was something similar needed now? Marcus wasn't entirely certain, but he was determined to have a plan, should an opportunity present itself. Of course, such a plan would hinge on his knowing exactly where Luganov was going to be at any given moment. Perhaps Alek could get him the president's schedule. Right now he was probably in the air, on the way home from North Korea. And once he was back in Moscow, why would Luganov go anywhere public if he was counting down the hours to a full-on invasion of three NATO countries? More likely, he would be holed up for the next few days in the Kremlin, huddling with his generals. Still, Marcus needed to be ready. He got up and went into the kitchen. Morris was still sitting at the table, now sending an encrypted cable back to Langley, a pot of tea at her side. "I need a weapon," Marcus said. "No, you don't," she said, not bothering to look up from her work. "You're never going to get near him." "You don't know that," he said. "But even if you're right, we still need an extraction plan for the Raven, don't we?" Now she looked up. "Yes, but I think I may have one." "You already have a weapon," she said, glancing at the Glock. "You're telling me that if something goes down, you really want me defending myself with an American sidearm? No, I need something Russian, something untraceable. A Wool and a Vinterez would do nicely." "A silent pistol and a sniper rifle?" The MSS Wool had been the standard-issue pistol for the KGB, Spetsnaz, and other Russian and Eastern Bloc assassins and spies since the early 1980s. It could fire a 7.62-millimeter round with impressive accuracy and make no more sound than a nearly inaudible metallic click. Even better, it emitted no smoke or flash. The VSS Vinterez, thread cutter in English, was a highly effective Soviet-era sniper rifle used by special forces. Traditionally equipped with a high-end telescopic sight, when it was fitted with a night vision scope, it became even deadlier. For the next 10 minutes, Marcus walked Morris through his idea to get the Raven out of the country. It was incredibly risky and somewhat complicated. It would require not just Morris's green light, but her active cooperation. And there was one big problem. Russians were almost certainly going to have to die. 4 of them, to be exact. Marcus didn't like it, and he said as much. But those were the facts. The Raven had a 4-man security detail with him at all times, Marcus told her. He had given them the slip once, on the night he came to the Hotel Nacional to meet with Marcus. It was too much to hope that the Raven would be alone again, especially in the lead-up to a major military operation. If Langley truly wanted this source in their hands, back in the U.S.,
or some place where they could debrief him to their heart's content, to learn every secret they possibly could about Luganov and the inner workings of his regime. Then this was the only way. Morris was quiet. She asked a few questions, and he provided what he thought were reasonable answers. Then the two just looked at each other. Finally, Morris excused herself. "Where are you going?" Marcus asked. "I need an answer."
"So do I," she said. "And this is above my pay grade."
71. Nova Agaryova, Russia, September 28th.
"Mr. President, we have a problem."
The tense voice on the other end of the phone belonged to FSB Chief Dmitry Nemkov.
"It had better be an emergency, Dmitry Mitrovich. I've only recently returned from North Korea, and it's the middle of the night,"
Luganov shouted into the receiver by his bed.
"What's wrong?"
"It's Clark, sir."
"What about him?"
"He just mobilized the 82nd and the 101st Airborne Divisions."
1 hour later, Luganov's chopper landed at the Kremlin. He strode into the cabinet room with Alek and Special Agent Kovalyov right behind him, and found his senior military and intelligence officials nervously waiting to give him a more detailed briefing. Nemkov took the lead, as Alek expected he would. In recent months, Alek had watched as Luganov leaned more and more heavily on the FSB chief and less on Defense Minister Petrovsky. Alek had first seen it on his trip to Vladivostok for the meeting with the North Korean leader. Nemkov had been the president's confidant, while Petrovsky was kept out of the loop on critical details of Luganov's meetings. And Petrovsky hadn't even been invited to come to Pyongyang on the most recent trip. Nemkov had been, and Alek had watched the 54-year-old spymaster, operating in a role Luganov himself had once held, not only taking commands from the president, but providing counsel that, from Alek's vantage point, was being listened to and even heeded. Nemkov, more than any other cabinet member, was emerging as Luganov's right-hand man. Alek had even begun to wonder if his father-in-law saw Nemkov as his heir apparent. Both men were ruthless and driven, and supremely comfortable with the dark arts of statecraft. And Nemkov knew his place. He was careful to be, or at least appear to be, exceedingly loyal to Luganov. And Luganov always rewarded loyalty. Nemkov began the briefing by explaining that while the news hadn't broken in the media yet, Russian intelligence had determined that the Pentagon was in the process of mobilizing and rapidly deploying more than 40,000 combat troops and special forces commandos, along with hundreds of battle tanks, heavy artillery, anti-aircraft batteries, and Patriot missile launchers. At the same time, at least a dozen fighter squadrons and four heavy bomber wings had been ordered to be prepared to leave American bases and head for Europe in the next 48 hours. Though it wasn't precisely clear where in Europe they were going, the FSB's operating presumption was that the squadrons were heading to the Baltics. Meanwhile, the Americans' carrier Strike Group 10, with its flagship USS Dwight D. Eisenhower, had just been ordered to move out of the North Atlantic and into the Baltic Sea. As best they could tell, Nemkov noted, the orders for the American ground forces were to deploy from bases across the American East Coast and Southwest to bases in Poland as part of NATO's ongoing enhanced forward presence. They weren't deploying to the Baltics yet, but 20 teams of American logistical officers had landed overnight in Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, strongly suggesting that the U.S. and other NATO forces would be arriving there within 4 to 5 days, and certainly no more than a week. Alek Kroskin fought to keep his head down and his expression neutral. In fact, he was ecstatic. He'd taken a huge, potentially lethal risk. but it appeared to be paying off. He'd read wire service reports that Senator Dayton had canceled his trip to Vilnius and flown all night back to Washington. He'd seen the 60 Minutes interview about Dayton's knockdown, drag-out fight with President Clark in the Oval Office, in which he said he had urged the president not to be deceived by Luganov, but to send a clear message of solidarity with our Baltic brothers. He'd also read a New York Times interview with Dayton, saying that despite the heated words he and the president had exchanged, he wanted to be crystal clear that he was offering the Clark administration his full support if the president did come to the aid of NATO's most vulnerable members, and promised to rally patriotic Democrats to make sure the effort was truly bipartisan. Alec's elation, however, was quickly extinguished. Before Nemkov had finished his briefing, Luganov erupted from his chair in a volcanic, profanity-laced tirade.
"One of you is a traitor, maybe more than one," the president raged.
Stunned silence filled the room.
"Whichever one of you leaked word of my war plans to the Americans will be found and executed for treason."
A chill ran down Alec's spine as the president ordered Nemkov to begin a mole hunt. But Luganov wasn't finished.
"You think you have stopped me?"
he thundered, scanning the faces of everyone seated around the table.
"You haven't stopped me. I will go forward with the invasion. I will expose Clark for the fool that he is. The Americans and the rest of NATO cannot possibly amass a force sufficient to deter us. There simply isn't time."
Alec was petrified. This could not be happening.
"Mikhail Borisovich, we will no longer strike on the 7th of October as planned,"
Luganov continued.
"I now order you to be ready to move on the 1st.
The defense minister looked ashen.
"The 1st of October?" he said.
"But, Alexander Ivanovich, this is not possible. That is only 3 days from now. My men will not be ready."
"They are not your men,"
Luganov bellowed.
"They are mine, and they will be ready. For the sake of Mother Russia, they will be ready, and they will bring us a great and glorious victory."
"Please, Your Excellency, the men can be ready by the 6th, maybe by the 5th, but I am not lying when I tell you that the 1st is simply too soon,"
Petrovsky insisted.
"Even if we could be ready by the 1st, we have clearly lost the element of surprise. Moreover, we must now consider the possibility that the FSB has grossly underestimated President Clark's ability to change course, to be unpredictable. And I must say, this seriously complicates our plans."
It was astonishing to see the defense minister openly disagreeing with Luganov, especially in the midst of such a tirade. But even as he took dictation of every word being spoken, Alec found himself secretly cheering for Petrovsky. Someone had to confront this madness. Someone had to move the president off of this catastrophic path. Before Luganov could respond, Nemkov weighed in.
"You are out of line, Mikhail Borisovich,"
the FSB chief said.
"Your statements show hesitancy, perhaps even cowardice. The president has not made a suggestion. He has given you a direct order. He wants to invade the Baltics on October 1st, and none of us in this room have seen you salute and say yes, have we?"
"I certainly have not,"
Luganov fumed.
"And I am waiting."
the words nearly vomited from his mouth. He was pacing about the room now, directly opposite Petrovsky, but heading in his direction.
"Alexander Ivanovich, please,"
said his defense minister.
"I have been with you on this plan every step of the way. But it was always premised on the element of surprise, on minimal American forces in the theater, on a lightning-fast strike, and then holding these states, knowing that neither the Americans nor anyone in NATO will risk a nuclear war to drive us out of the lands that are rightfully ours. These are your words, not mine. No one has been more supportive of you than have I. Indeed, I have worked night and day for months to make your plan a reality. But we must be honest with ourselves and concede that the strategic situation has just seriously and sweepingly changed, and not to our advantage."
"I concede nothing!"
bellowed Luganov, still moving toward Petrovsky.
"But, sir, what if we invade now, and the Americans decide to fight back? What if Clark is stronger than the FSB tells us, more determined than we around this table have supposed? What if he does not blink? What if he actually invokes Article 5, and we find ourselves in a nuclear Armageddon with the Americans and all of Europe?"
This impassioned plea literally stopped Luganov in his tracks. The room was silent. Every eye shifted from Petrovsky to the president. Even Alek forced himself to look up from his notebook to wait for the answer. The defense minister's logic was sound. His loyalties were unimpeachable. The man was risking not only his career, but his very life, out of a profound sense of duty and love of country. The contrast between Petrovsky and Nemkov had never been so clear. Luganov was now gripping the backs of two chairs so hard, his knuckles were white. His jaw was set. He was visibly controlling his breathing, and his voice became somber and filled with menace.
"Let me make myself perfectly clear. NATO is finished," he said quietly. "And if Clark gets in my way, so is he."
With that, he ordered the defense minister to put all Russian strategic nuclear forces on full alert, to ready the air and ground forces for an October 1st invasion, or resign immediately, and be taken into custody on charges of treason and sedition. Alek felt physically ill. He turned cautiously to Petrovsky, hoping desperately for the man to take a stand. But he did not. The defense minister was trembling as he uttered the words,
"Very well, Your Excellency."
72. Luganov was going to war, regardless of what the general said. Alek lit a cigarette, shuddering at the implications, and concluded he had to talk privately with Petrovsky, and soon. The defense minister might not be the only man of reason in the entire cabinet, but if there were others who believed their leader was foolish for playing a game of nuclear chicken with an American president who had never fought a war, nor ever served in the military, yet prided himself in being unpredictable, they were keeping their counsel to themselves. Only Petrovsky had demonstrated the courage to speak his mind. The last cabinet member who had tried to do so was the Army Chief of Staff, and he had been arrested and banished to the outer reaches of the Empire. If it was possible to dissuade Luganov from the disastrous path he was on, it had to happen fast, for they were rapidly running out of time. Perhaps together, Alek thought, He and Petrovsky could devise a way to talk Luganov off the ledge. It was risky. But he resolved to find a pretext to call Petrovsky the moment the man returned to the defense ministry. Maybe they could meet later in the day to consider their options, meager and dwindling though they were. Yet, as everyone gathered their papers and rushed out of the cabinet room, Luganov summoned Alek to meet with him privately in his office. He was as angry as Alek had ever seen him. But the volcanic eruption was over. Gone was the spewing molten lava, replaced by an icy discipline that unnerved Alek even more.
"I may have to sack Petrovsky if he cannot do his job," the president said, the moment Alek shut the door behind them. "I will not abide disloyalty."
"Should I go speak to him?"
Alek asked, sensing an opening. But Luganov slammed that door shut.
"No,"
he said, walking over to the windows and looking out over the Kremlin grounds.
"I made my expectations clear. If Petrovsky can't meet them, there's no use going to speak with him. Talk instead to his deputy, Shishkin. Make sure he understands his commander's intent, and make sure Shishkin is ready to step into his boss's shoes if a change must be made."
Alek said he would do that, and asked if that would be all. But there was more.
"We need the word to leak that the crisis has, in fact, been diffused, and that what I said in Pyongyang was the truth."
Luganov turned back to Alek and sat behind his desk.
"Call the German foreign minister. What's his name? Frankel, right. You two are close, are you not?"
"Close enough,"
Alek said.
"Fine. Reach out to him. Take his temperature. Let him know that you've just come out of a meeting with me and heard me issue orders to cancel all exercises near the Baltics and Ukraine tomorrow. Tell him Russian troops should begin pulling out on the 1st. Also imply, but carefully, that Clark may be in over his head and in danger of seriously misreading the situation. Then call that guy in Madrid, the one who was here last month.
Galdos,"
Alek recalled.
"Carlos Ruiz Galdos, the Speaker of their parliament."
"Right.
Call him,"
Luganov insisted.
"We funneled money to their party through the Venezuelans last year, correct?"
"Yes, sir."
"Good. Don't bring that up, of course. But he should be helpful."
"Anyone else?"
"No. Two should be enough. Coming directly from you, this will be given great weight. I guarantee the word will spread through the leadership of NATO before our heads hit the pillow tonight."
Alek had his notebook open. He was taking careful notes of every assignment and becoming nauseated with each word he wrote.
"But first, I want you to call Marina," Luganov added. "Tell her everything is fine. Tell her war will not come. I don't want her to worry. Better yet, tell her you're taking her to Monaco next weekend, now that the threat of war has passed."
"Monaco?
Yes. Yes, tell her that. She will be thrilled,"
Luganov continued.
"Tell her, I've been working you too hard. You're not getting enough time with her. Tell her to start booking flights and a hotel. She'll tell her girlfriends." "I know, my girl. Word will spread to all her friends, and then to their parents, that the clouds are lifting and the storm has passed. Her friends' parents are bankers, hedge fund managers, CEOs. They have many friends and contacts in the West, and they will spread the news even faster than the politicians. And the effect on our markets will be very positive. We will make money today, Alek, you and I. We will make a great deal of money."
Alek still could not believe how sanguine this man could be about taking the country into a completely unnecessary and highly risky war with NATO. Just then, the intercom on the desk buzzed. Luganov's secretary said the FSB chief was waiting to see him. The president said he would be right with him.
That is all, Alex Stefanovich. Check back with me when you're done with all this. I will have more.